Welcome to the Regulatory Transparency Project's fourth branch podcast series. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Welcome to the Regulatory Transparency Project's Tech Roundup podcast. My name is Matthew Feeney. I'm the director of the Cato Institute's Project on Emerging Technologies, and I am joined today by Caleb Watney, the Resident Fellow in Technology and Innovation at the R Street Institute, and Ash Kazarian, who is the Director of Civil Liberties at Tech Freedom. Hi, guys.
Hey.
Hey, Matt.
So we're in a bit of an interesting situation. I'm sat in my bedroom in Alexandria because we are not able to meet thanks to the ongoing coronavirus pandemic, but thanks to the wonders of modern technology, we can nonetheless record a podcast. And today's is on facial recognition, which I know the three of us have all spent a decent amount of time thinking about. And I'm wondering, maybe just to set the groundwork, we should maybe make sure the audience knows what we mean when we think about the technology. So let's kick it off with you, Caleb. When you hear the phrase facial recognition, what kind of family tree are we talking about with this technology?
Yeah, great question. It's always good to kind of start off with a technical overview of some of these technologies. So like with a lot of other technologies, facial recognition is kind of a broad category, which refers to a family of technologies. And sometimes they all get lumped in together when it would be useful to have more differentiation. Kind of broadly, this is all part of like image or video recognition. So basically trying to recognize shapes within images and videos and then sort of creating patterns that then allow you to recognize, oh, that's the same face we've seen here. So typically they're scanning for the geometry of a face. They're trying to recognize key features like nose size, eye shape, how prominent your chin is, and then like the distances between them. That allows the creator then create a virtual map of a face, which it can then match against other scanned faces in its database. Usually with a corresponding confidence threshold. That's kind of like, you know, a very basic overview. But there's also other technologies like sort of sometimes like emotional analysis, trying to recognize like, oh, is a face happy or sad or exhibiting aggression or anger, which doesn't necessarily match to faces and is a different, you know, sort of variation of facial recognition, but frequently gets caught up within it. And then, you know, now today with the coronavirus, we're also seeing, you know, similar using the same sort of cameras and sensors. You can sometimes do body temperature checks as they're doing in China. So there's lots of different kinds of analysis you can do with sort of broad, you know, camera video technology. But yeah, that's a basic overview.
Yeah. So Ash, you're the director of civil liberties over at Tech Freedom. What are the civil liberties implications of facial recognition?
So I would start with how facial recognition is used. Obviously, it's a plethora of things, and a lot of rights are being kind of pinged when it happens. But on the high level, number one is arrest identification. So when an individual is arrested and booked, police may use the mugshot photo taken during the booking to later identify an individual who does not provide an identity or to confirm that identity. So that's number one, right? Number two is field identification. So that's something that when facial recognition is used by police officers that work in the field to identify an individual that they're speaking with, or that can include discussions with witnesses or victims of a crime, but usually primarily focuses on individuals that officers stop during a patrol. Then there is investigative identification. So let's say police is investigating a crime and they may obtain an image of a suspect through a photograph or video footage. And this could involve crime scene footage or police photographing an identified subject when they're trailing someone. And then law enforcement uses facial recognition to try to find out who that person is. And in cases like this, it gets very murky and all of these can get very murky and we can go deeper into that later. And then there's real-time surveillance. So this is scanning all the faces. So what Caleb mentioned with coronavirus, and right now we know this was happening in China, where there's like a live feed and all the faces during a video feed are being run against a certain list. So let's say a country has a watch list or has a list of people who've already been confirmed to have a disease, right, in the coronavirus 2020 world. And then the contents of such list, obviously, sometimes, depending on the country, so that's China, that's just, they're very, very frivolous with how they use this technology. In the United States, it would be more like people who are on the list who are threats to public safety, terrorist watch list, things like that. Or it could be broad. So it always varies, but it's a very, very broad-reaching technology. And then this is how the users are that I would say are kind of the key that we should focus on, but I'm happy to let you kind of go in other directions. And then there are problems with the users that we can dive into next.
Sure, go ahead, Caleb.
It might also be useful to just quickly highlight some of the commercial sort of non-police, non-state uses of facial recognition as well. So probably the ones that people are most familiar with would be things like, you know, facial recognition on your smartphone. It's usually a pretty good privacy preserving way of unlocking a smartphone that doesn't rely on like a password or key code that could either, you know, be forgotten or taken from someone. It's also used in a lot of sort of facial or photo matching algorithms. So Google Photos, Facebook can automatically tag your friends or suggest here's who we think is in these programs. Those are probably the two most common uses people have run into. And then there's also sort of out of the box uses. So Amazon Web Services has a bunch of different AI tools that you can use as part of their platform for any number of possible uses. One of them is sort of like basic face matching, pattern matching recognition.
Well, so what I'm hearing, and I guess I'll play devil's advocate a little, is that the technology can be used to track people on terror watch lists or to identify arrested persons. And it has potentially very valuable uses commercially. And one of the more exciting applications I've heard of is the possibly eventual elimination of tickets, so you can just walk into a train station and walk on the train and you're automatically debited thanks to facial recognition. So Ash, maybe I could ask you, what's the problem here, right? We have a new technology that seems very convenient in a commercial setting, and if we have databases full of bad guys, what's the problem for law-abiding residents and citizens?
So number one problem that still exists, because obviously the technology is not perfect and its use it's not perfect, is accuracy. Facial recognition is just not as accurate as a lot of people think it is. So there have been numerous studies. One was co-authored by an FBI expert that have found this especially true in identifying and classifying women and people with darker skin tones. But also ACLU actually matched, they did this experiment in 2018, and they matched 28 members of Congress with mugshots. So they matched all the members and 28 pinged against random people's mugshots. So I think that really made a lot of members actually freak out a little bit and be more suspicious of this technology. MIT Media Lab, Amazon System Recognition, had much more difficulty in telling the gender of female faces and our skin faces. So what I just already outlined. So depending on the system, sometimes they glitch. FBI experts have also outlined the dangers that already exist, you know, over policed communities, like let's say Muslim communities in America or communities of color. There's also failure to deal with a problem of how do we then proceed from that? Let's say, so I mentioned the live feed or the use where you would ping someone's face from the crime scene. Often the way law enforcement has been using it is they would hear from eyewitnesses and they would say, the guy who ran out of a store looked like Liam Neeson. And they would take the photo of the actor and they would run it against all the faces from the feed from the outside of the store to see, on the side street, let's say. So you don't have the actual person who ran out of a store. You don't have that moment, but you have like an angle that potentially that person could be in. And then they just run that face against it. And it's just like, if you look like that actor, you would be brought in. Your rights would be limited. You would have to hire an attorney or ask for a public defendant. Like your life is going to be derailed just because you look like someone. And things like that are very tricky. And again, the disproportionate effect on communities of color.
Something I always try to point out to people is I think the scale of the databases that at least federal agencies use is pretty vast. There's a Georgetown study that came out a few years ago called the Perpetual Lineup that I urge listeners to check out. And I believe it was at the time of publication that something like 24 states just volunteer their DMV data for law enforcement searches, specifically from the FBI. And I think that that's their estimate is something like 1 in 2 American adults are already in some kind of law enforcement facial recognition network. But Caleb, something that maybe the listeners might be interested in, if you know, we're technology policy people working in DC, do we really treat this like a technology policy problem, or is this a law enforcement privacy law problem? Because it strikes me that you could make an argument that we have these debates about new emerging technologies and their implications on privacy, but is it a mistake to maybe focus on the technology too much, or should we be thinking about this from more of a 30,000 foot view?
Yeah, I think it's probably useful to try to combine the two lenses, because that's really where you see some of the interesting problems. You know, Ash mentioned this ACLU study that used Amazon's facial recognition database, you know, to match mugshots, you know, against members of Congress. Amazon responded to this study by saying that when you used their recommended 99% confidence threshold, which is, you know, sort of like a technical specification, that a lot of those false matches went away. I think all of them did. But the real issue here is that you can have a technical fix, but that doesn't mean it's going to be applied in the situations where you want it. So a lot of the, you know, police a lot of the police departments around the country that are using facial recognition, we don't have very good ways of verifying that they actually are using the recommended confidence threshold. And a lot of these tools, it's just like a slider that you can, you know, bring down and say, oh, I actually want to use the 70% confidence threshold because I wasn't getting any matches at the 99%, you know, confidence threshold. So let me just pull that down. And so, yeah, I think it's really about the intersection of what happens when you have these new technological tools that provide lots of really great use cases, but also some concerning use cases if used by actors who aren't, you know, fully aware of what they're doing or without the, you know, proper safeguards. With I think a lot of the most concerning use cases are in sort of domains where civil liberties and privacy advocates have been the most concerned, which is mostly government use of the technology. Primarily, you know, the government has the ability to deprive you of your life and liberty in a way that private actors can't typically do. It's a lot more concerning for you if, you know, you are falsely, you know, brought in for questioning or, you know, deprived of your life and liberty in some other way than if you get a false or a bad Tinder, you know, date because its algorithm messed up, or if your Facebook feed, you know, tags the wrong friend. So there's a very big level of harm differential, I guess, between the private sector and the public sector, which is worth reflecting on. And I think the other big difference between the private and the public sector is what's the degree of exit? What's the degree of competition? So if I don't like the way that Facebook is matching, you know, my photos, I can take all my photos to Google instead. Or I can just tell them, no, that's not the right, you know, person that you're tagging, and they'll mostly stop. But you can't tell your local police department to stop matching you against their facial recognition algorithm. You know, you don't have the same ability to exit that.
Ash, I'm curious, if it was announced that Washington, D.C.'s public transport was allowing for residents to opt into a facial recognition system so that residents would be able to avoid having to use their Metro card or to pay in cash when they hop on a bus or a train, what kind of assurances would you need as far as privacy goes before you would take part in a system like that?
Well, I would start by saying that it's not even my rights that I worry about, even though I am an immigrant and I'm not a citizen, so my rights are limited to begin with. But it's, as I said, minorities, people of color, women, and the assurances that you need first and foremost are actually tied into due process. So you would have to know that these databases are not shared with law enforcement. Automatically, like, you have to know that these databases have very, very limited use. And you also have to have the other option always available on the DC public transport. So let's say you're getting on a bus and the system suddenly isn't working, or the system isn't recognizing you, or the system is shut down. I mean, I don't know about you guys, but I never carry cash. I don't know if it's a millennial thing or if it's just me thing. But there has to be some other way that then they can accommodate you as a person for the service. So that's number one. Number two, so what Caleb said about commercial versus government, it makes sense. And obviously, I'm guessing you, Matthew, asked this question because DC public transport is kind of like a very funny hybrid between the two. But the thing is, so I don't even want to talk about commercial use when we're talking about government use, just because those are two completely different paradigms. And they're important in different ways. And obviously, as Caleb said, government has way more power over you. And that's why we need to focus on it first. And then just the commercial use is so different. And the questions that arise from it and the problems and our policies that are going to come from it would have to be different. So it is very discouraging when you see members of Congress try to regulate both at the same time. So I would say that.
How do we think about, though, the law enforcement use of privately built or private databases? Many of you I'm sure both of you know, and listeners may be familiar with the New York Times reporting on a company called Clearview, which scraped billions of images from millions of websites. And the creators were arguing, well, look, you know, people put up these images online, and all we did was just scrape publicly available images to build a facial recognition search engine so that not just private companies like Macy's, but law enforcement agencies can use this tool to identify suspects and others. Caleb, what do you think about, though, even if we're thinking about the potential commercial benefits, how do we make sure that law enforcement don't abuse their access to those kind of systems?
Yeah, no, that's it's a really hard question, I think. This is partially where it's helpful to have a lot more oversight over the ways that, public sector actors are using these technologies. So, yeah, one, there's a lot of times when we don't even know the full extent of how, law enforcement or, the FBI or whatnot are using these tools. And so more sort of transparency in the first place of what kind of tools or services they're using. Because prior to a lot of that New York Times reporting, we had no idea that, they were using this service called Clearview or in what ways they were using it. So more transparency on the front end and then more accountability on the back end. I think the other thing that's important to think about with especially law enforcement usage is maybe the asymmetry of usage. So I think once you sort of allow and have broad public acceptance of a lot of these technologies, it's very hard to undo it after the fact versus if you delay or try to have more, if you err on the side of caution in terms of how police are using these technologies or being allowed to use them on the front end, it's easier to then recognize and say, okay, maybe we've been over stringent. We can now let you use it in this additional case. So I think especially for police use, I would err on the side of being overcautious of having too many, rules and regulations on the front end before they can use these tools. But before we can even get to what kinds of guidelines should they be having, we have to know what they're using in the first place.
Yeah, Ash, do you think that police should have to get a warrant or some kind of other permission from a judge before conducting facial recognition searches? What should the standard be? Or should we allow law enforcement to purchase private tools to use for these kind of investigations?
So there are multiple things that can be done at the same time. And the problem that I think we need to address first, and that unfortunately a lot of people who work in this space on other issues like surveillance reform run into, and I've personally run into, is the government sees themselves, and often they are, as the protectors of peace, people who keep the country together and people safe. So for them, they are trying to access tools to save people. So number one is not vilifying law enforcement, unless we see clear evidence of abuse, is a good place to start these negotiations and these conversations. Number two is realizing that a lot of law enforcement already uses these tools. So taking them away would be borderline impossible, and it's not a good starter. So, you know, a lot of folks talk about bans and moratoriums, and I understand the value of negotiating from a place of power, but at the same time, there has to be middle ground because these technologies do help. There's a lot of good uses that come, and there are crimes that are being, you know, solved because of them. So going from that to your question about a warrant, I think requiring judicial authorization based on probable cause for using facial recognition for identification is a very normal start for this. I also think that one of the biggest things that we don't even think about often when we talk about facial recognition is requiring prosecution to disclose that facial recognition was used in identifying the person who is being prosecuted, the defendant. Often, there were a bunch of studies that show that often when that requirement is put in place, the prosecution actually drops their case altogether because that's kind of the cornerstone that's keeping the whole case together, and that's not enough. If you didn't even know this was used, that's violating your constitutional rights. So that's another thing. There is also something to be said about limiting real-time facial recognition to emergency situations, right? And then people like us should sit in a room until hopefully we can sit in a room together one day soon. But we should sit in a room and not get out until we figure out what emergency is it for this case, what exceptions there are, look into future, because I think even 6 months ago, a pandemic wouldn't have been on our top five list of things that we should think an emergency for real-time facial recognition use would be. And then there should be requirements like independent verification after the algorithm or, you know, the technology has identified someone. So that can be human sitting. So it's something I would say an analogy can be made to content moderator. Not that I want to compare these two technologies, but after an algorithm makes a decision, it definitely should go to a person. And then the person has to verify it. So things like that are very, very kind of important things to start with. We can also, you know, we should maybe think about limiting use of facial recognition for felonies or let's say misdemeanors and felonies. Like this is conversations that we should be having instead of a conversation about should we ban it or should we not ban it? Because right now, a lot of the, not us, not three of us, but a lot of the folks who work in this space, I either on the side of a spectrum that say moratorium or a ban, and then the others are on the side of a spectrum that say don't touch it, it's perfect. And neither of those are just true.
I think it's easy for the three of us, of course, you know, being policy wonks in DC to talk about this. But if you're a local lawmaker or official in a city or county, and you learn that this technology is being deployed by law enforcement, you're going to come under pressure to act. And Caleb, I'm wondering if I'd like to get your thoughts on what lawmakers in places like Cambridge, Massachusetts, and San Francisco have done, which is basically to implement the kind of ban that Ash just alluded to. What do you think about that kind of approach?
Yeah, I have mixed feelings, because I think, as Ash rightly points out, there are a lot of useful applications of these tools that can be, public safety enhancing. And there's also like a lot of practical use cases that sometimes get swept up under a ban. So there's, you know, practical questions like if you have a ban on facial recognition for public sector actors, does that mean that, you know, public sector employees who have phones, you know, can they not enable the facial unlock, ability, or can you not use facial recognition to verify employees coming and going from very, you know, top security government facilities? So you sometimes have, weird corner case uses that get swept up under a broader ban. But I think I'm a little bit more sympathetic towards local officials who feel like I'm just under so much pressure. It seems like there's a lot of really bad use cases happening right now. And, you know, let's just take a pause right now so that we can get the right kinds of you know, safeguards in place? Because there's a lot that, you know, we can say, oh, do these 10 things, but, you know, a lot of them are going to manner, or it's going to depend a lot on how the local police department has been using it in the past, how much trust is there between, you know, the local population and the police. And all these sorts of questions about at what level do you set it? Like, are you going to make sure the jaywalkers aren't being, you know, swept up into these? Are you only, you know, requiring it for felonies? What kind of third party checks are you going to do to validate the software? You know, how are you making sure that there's a lot of databases that aren't as reliable, aren't getting, you know, swept up into these tools as well? There's a lot of like really difficult questions there that are hard issues of technological governance. And so like I have my own questions about how effective bans will be or whether or not police will be trying to go around them in some other way. But I think like at a basic level, I'm somewhat sympathetic to the idea that these are there's a lot of really hard technological governance questions here. If you want to hit the pause button for 2 years while you try to set these safeguards, I don't know. You could have questions about efficiency, but at least in principle there, I'm not like opposed to that as an instinct.
I want to make sure to highlight the fact that, let's say, cities only have jurisdiction over city employees. So if a sheriff's department has a facial recognition system, they could still use it within city limits. I believe this was brought up during like a Portland review. Like in Portland, they were reviewing these questions on city level, and this was brought up. And it really got a lot of folks thinking. And I think that's right. And I'm pretty sure, and that's what I was referring to. And I don't want to, again, I don't want to paint law enforcement in dark colors, but like if you give them tools and they can still use them under authority they're granted, they're going to. You can't put the genie back into the bottle. And so I think it's just like, it's very important to be realistic about it.
I think it might be helpful to discuss the broader implications of the technology. After the news of Clearview came out, there was some discussion about the argument that the company was making, namely that, look, if you're out in public and someone takes your photo and they share it with the world, if they put it on Facebook or they tweet it or something like that, you don't really have a privacy in that because you are outside. And in the 21st century, it's just a normal part of life that if you go out to a bar or someone's party or something, you might end up on a photo. And sorry if that ends up on a facial recognition system, but that's just what happens. Is that just a fact of life we're going to have to get used to? Or do you see the emergence of this technology actually reshaping a debate about privacy in public spaces?
So Sonia Sotomayor, and I just pulled this up because I knew we were going to talk about this. In her concurring opinion in United States v. Jones, she said that digital technologies that are available at relatively low cost, such a substantial quantum of intimate information about any person whom the government, in its unfettered discretion, chooses to track, may alter the relationship between the citizen and government in a way that is inimical to democratic society. And I think that's a huge question. And I think the Supreme Court has to figure it out, because I honestly can't even begin to fathom the border between us living our lives in the technological digital era and our constitutional rights and all the uses that can violate them.
Your thoughts, Caleb?
Yeah, no, I think that's a great quote. And there's a lot of really, I mean, partially we're trying to imagine, you know, how is facial recognition technology going to develop and evolve over the next 10 years? And that's very hard to forecast. It's even harder sometimes to forecast how are, you know, citizens going to respond to this. You've seen, you know, China is in some ways, you know, on much, much further than us in terms of deployment of these technologies. And while there has been some pushback, there have been, you know, some signs of public support that some people like this. But I guess I'm skeptical that people in the United States are going to be as amenable to that as maybe people in China have. And partially that's due to we each have stronger norms around privacy and a lack of surveillance. But maybe as an example, when the camera was first developed, you know, there was a lot of privacy concern about, well, what does this mean? You know, before you had a reasonable right to privacy for, you know, sort of what your face looked like, unless you were willing to sit around for a portrait, you know, for 3 hours for someone to sketch it out. But suddenly, you know, someone with a camera could snap your picture, print it out, and then, you know, post it all over town. And that was a pretty large change. Culture kind of adapted. And while there are now social norms around, like if you try taking out a camera in a bathroom, you're going to get lots of odd stares. Obviously, we have some, peeping Tom laws or whatnot. But generally, sort of social norms around privacy adapted in a way that said, this is a really cool tool. We want it. I'm a little bit skeptical that that's going to happen in the same way for facial recognition. But I guess we shouldn't necessarily totally rule it out. I think as we've kind of been hammering on over the course of this episode, it does seem like the most concerning uses are in the public sector. And while the genie is out of the bottle a little bit in the sense that, you know, there are a lot of police departments that are using it, I think there's a lot more that the genie could go. And so, you know, if we can slow it down while we're trying to figure out useful safeguards, I think that sounds reasonable.
Great. Thanks, Caleb. I'm aware that we are probably testing the patience of the audience here, but I'll just wrap up by saying that all three of us have written quite a bit on this. And if you're interested in at least following the work that I do at Cato, you can go to Cato, CATO.org, or follow me on Twitter at @M_Feeney. Caleb and Ash, what's the best way for people to get in touch with you or follow your work?
Yeah. So I'm fairly active on Twitter. My handle is @CalebWatney. Feel free to follow or reach out to me there. You can also email me at cwatney@rstreet.org.
And I'm on Twitter at @ashkhen. And also you can find my work on techfreedom.org or ashkenkazarian.com.
Great. Thank you, guys. Thank you for doing this over a remote system. Usually we would be doing this, of course, in person, and I hope that we'll be able to see each other in not too long. But to the audience, thanks for listening. Please click subscribe, rate, all the other nice things you do to podcasts, and we'll reconvene hopefully again for another podcast in the near future. Thank you.
On behalf of the Federal Society's Regulatory Transparency Project, thanks for tuning in to the Fourth Branch Podcast. To catch every new episode when it's released, you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spreaker. For the latest from RTP, please visit our website at regproject.org. That's regproject.org.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.